There's a time and place, I mentioned, for medication. There's also a time and place for thyroid surgery, but in most cases, it should be a last resort. I kind of knew there were alternatives, and one of those alternatives is an herb called bugleweed. And bugleweed is an herb with anti-thyroid properties. Eventually, I added something else called motherwort, which is another herb, and that helps with the cardiovascular system. Whatever approach you take, you want to definitely do things to address an underlying cause.
If you haven't done so already, go ahead and click that subscribe button down below. It's a little red button. You punch that, and it's going to notify you every time we put out a new episode that can help you improve your bone health. And then also, if you haven't done so already, head over to bonecoach.com, sign up for the free 7-day osteoporosis kickstart. That's going to walk you through everything you need to be doing right now to get on the path to improvement and stronger bones. After you do those two things, go ahead and press play on this episode, and I'll see you inside. Welcome to this episode of the Bone Coach Show. Joining us today to explore hyperthyroidism, osteoporosis, and bone loss is Dr. Eric Osansky. Dr. Eric is a chiropractor, clinical nutritionist, and a certified functional medicine practitioner who helps people recover from thyroid and autoimmune thyroid conditions. He's the author of the books Natural Treatment Solutions for Hyperthyroidism and Graves' Disease and Hashimoto's Triggers, and is the host of the Save My Thyroid podcast. Dr. Eric Osansky was personally diagnosed in 2008 with Graves' Disease, and after taking a natural treatment approach, has been in remission since 2009. After seeing how well natural treatment methods helped with his condition, he began using these natural thyroid treatment protocols to help others with different types of thyroid and autoimmune thyroid conditions, including hyperthyroidism, Graves' disease, hypothyroidism, and Hashimoto's thyroiditis. It is an absolute pleasure to have you here. I'm really excited to dive into this topic today. Dr. Eric, great to have you.
Yeah, same here, Kevin. Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited as well.
Great. So let's dive into this. And I always love starting out. Help me understand, you know, your personal journey through this. What's your background, your personal experience with Graves' disease?
Sure. So as you mentioned, my background is a chiropractor. And for a number of years, I was practicing just regular chiropractic. And then in 2008, I was just at a Sam's Club walking around. And, you know, they have those automated blood pressure machines. And I took my blood pressure, and my blood pressure was fine, but my resting heart rate was elevated, and which was unusual. And so just over the next few days, I would just multiple times per day take my resting heart rate at home, and it remained elevated somewhere anywhere between like 90 and 110 beats per minute. And, you know, and so I figured something was wrong. And, you know, I was also losing weight, but I was also dieting and detoxifying. So I really didn't attribute the weight loss to anything. And also I had a voracious appetite, which is common with hyperthyroidism. And, but again, I didn't put the pieces together until that elevated resting heart rate. So I ended up going to a primary care doctor who did a thyroid panel, diagnosed me with hyperthyroidism, and then went and saw an endocrinologist, and she's the one that officially diagnosed me with Graves' disease. And you know, at that time, I didn't know anybody who had hyperthyroidism, Graves' disease, but I did in the past, as part of my continuing education credits, I attended a few functional endocrinology seminars. And so I knew there were alternatives to the medication and the radioactive iodine. And so I had in my mind that I was going to take a natural approach, which I did. And long story short, that was in 2008 into 2009, and I've been in remission since then, since 2009. And since then, also working with others with hyperthyroidism, Graves' disease, as well as hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's.
That's fantastic. And that's like, I always love hearing people that have gone from one health condition to making improvement and progress in that area. And, you know, taking that as their impetus for helping and serving other people, you know, with those conditions. So we've talked about, or we've already mentioned the hyperthyroidism, Graves' disease, hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's. Can we just outline what those things, what are those, what are the differences in symptoms and things like that?
Sure. So what hypothyroidism is a lot more common than hyperthyroidism, and hypothyroidism, you have low thyroid hormone levels. So if a doctor was doing a thyroid panel, you'd see low T3, T4, which are the most common thyroid hormones, the main thyroid hormones. And you'd also have an elevated TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, which is a pituitary hormone that signals to the thyroid glands to either produce thyroid hormone or to slow down the production of thyroid hormone. And some of the symptoms associated with hypothyroidism due to that lower thyroid hormone, a lot of times you'll get fatigue, brain fog, weight gain, and coldness is very common when it comes to low thyroid. And so with hyperthyroidism, it's the opposite. You have that increase in thyroid hormone. So again, on a thyroid panel, you'll have an increase in T3 and T4. And because the pituitary gland is trying to signal to the thyroid gland to slow down, do not produce thyroid hormone, you hardly get any TSH. Usually you get a low to depressed thyroid stimulating hormone. And then because of that increased thyroid hormone, everything's sped up. So you get, in my situation, again, I mentioned how I had that increased resting heart rate, heart palpitations. I had weight loss. I experienced about 42 pounds worth of weight loss, increased appetite. Some people experience loose stools, and insomnia is pretty common, anxiety, insomnia. And so those essentially are the differences between hyperthyroidism and hypothyroidism. And then I'll add that most of these thyroid conditions are autoimmune. So in the case of hyperthyroidism, most people with hyperthyroidism have Graves' disease, where the immune system is attacking the TSH receptors of thyroid. And with Hashimoto's, you get different types of antibodies, but in that case, you have the immune system damaging the thyroid gland, which is what over time leads to the thyroid hormone levels getting low. And one more thing I'll add is what hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's, sometimes a little bit tricky, just because a lot of people are subclinical, meaning that their thyroid hormone levels might be within the lab reference range, but not within the optimal range. They might actually not be low, and the TSH sometimes is outside of the lab reference range, but many times it's within the lab reference range, but not optimal. Whereas with hyperthyroidism, it's usually diagnosed a lot quicker just because, you know, it shows up on a thyroid panel a lot sooner than hypothyroidism. And also the symptoms, not to minimize the symptoms associated with hypothyroidism, but with hyperthyroidism, when someone has a elevated resting heart rate and they're losing a lot of weight. And there's also, I didn't mention thyroid eye disease, which some people have, where they have like the bulging of the eyes or increased eye pressure. Again, the symptoms usually prompt the person to go to a doctor. And since the symptoms are arguably more severe than hypothyroidism, you know, usually it's diagnosed a lot quicker than hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's.
So it seems like if you have issues with your thyroid, there are a lot of different areas within our own bodies that are going to be affected by that. Like, how important is a healthy functioning thyroid? What all is being affected?
Yeah, pretty much every cell tissue in the body is affected by thyroid hormone. So you definitely don't want too little thyroid hormone. Again, you deal with the bone, and it's important for, you know, remodeling of the bone. If you have too much, and we'll talk more about that, but, you know, it's important for bone remodeling, but it's important for really every cell, the kidneys, the liver. I mean, if you have low thyroid hormone, if you don't have enough thyroid hormone, you'll definitely be in trouble. And then, you know, if you have hyperthyroidism, too much thyroid hormone, then again, it's a different story. With hypothyroidism, there's the problem is with any hormone deficiency, you don't want to be deficient. But again, you know, with too much, like again, when we talk about, you know, with the bone, that could actually accelerate the bone remodeling process and lead to like low bone density, osteoporosis. But yeah, you definitely don't want too much or too little thyroid hormone.
And so with hyperthyroidism, so this is something we haven't actually talked about really before on this podcast, at least to date. And what is happening in terms of our bones if we have hyperthyroidism? How is that impacting our bone health? You just mentioned, you know, bone density and possible contributor to bone loss. Can you explain that and explore that a little bit more?
Yeah. So with healthy bones, I'm sure you cover this in other episodes, but there's the osteoblasts, which are important for bone formation, and osteoclasts, which break down bone. And, you know, both of these are important with the bone remodeling process, the bone. And so with, you know, if you have too little thyroid hormone, so we'll go there first before the hyperthyroidism. Again, you need that healthy thyroid hormone levels for proper bone turnover to form new bone over time. And, you know, so if you have hyperthyroidism, that's all sped up and you have essentially increased bone turnover. And over time, if that's not addressed, if the thyroid hormone levels remain elevated and you keep on getting that accelerated bone turnover, that essentially is leading over time to a decrease in bone density. You know, usually first will present as osteopenia and eventually can lead to osteoporosis.
And are there, other than, I know you mentioned a couple of different thyroid panel markers, what are some of the other markers that people can be looking at that could possibly be an indicator that they've got hyperthyroidism and it could be impacting these other areas of the body, including our bones? What are some of the other things that we would be looking for?
So you mean as far as the actual thyroid markers or other markers besides thyroid, or?
Yeah. So to get that full picture, so you mentioned the T3, the T4, the TSH. Are there other important markers that we would want to be looking at in those situations too?
Sure. So with the thyroid, there's, again, so the main thyroid hormones, like we mentioned, T3, T4, and that thyroid stimulating hormone, TSH. And then there's the antibodies. So with Graves' disease, typically you have thyroid stimulating immunoglobulins, which is a type of TSH receptor. And when you have those antibodies, that means the immune system specifically is stimulating, attacking those TSH receptors. And that's what's causing the excess production of thyroid hormone. And then with Hashimoto's, you have anti-thyroglobulin antibodies, as well as thyroid peroxidase antibodies. And those are more indicative of damage taking place at the thyroid gland. And honestly, it's very common for people to have multiple antibodies. So those, for example, those TPO antibodies, those thyroid peroxidase antibodies, most people, just about everybody with Hashimoto's will have those. There's exceptions where some will be negative and they'll just have those anti-thyroglobulin antibodies. But then there are, I think, like, depends on the research, but some sources will say 60 to 80% of people with Graves' disease will have those elevated TPO antibodies, which I do see. When I dealt with Graves, I only had the TSI, the thyroid stimulating immunoglobulins positive, but I do see a lot of patients with those TPO antibodies. And then there are people that have all three of those antibodies. And so those are three other markers, those antibodies. There's actually other antibodies too, but those are the most common antibodies. There's also, so T4 needs to convert into T3, which is the active form of thyroid hormone. But there's also something called reverse T3, where T4 deactivates. And we actually, in hyperthyroidism, I stopped testing reverse T3 just because when you have that elevated thyroid hormone levels, the body's trying to deactivate thyroid hormone. So you actually see reverse T3 very high in most people with hyperthyroidism. So it's really not giving us too much helpful information. Whereas in someone with Hashimoto's hypothyroidism, that's where you might want to test that reverse T3. And then I don't know if you want to get into other markers like alkaline phosphatase, for example, is one that's not thyroid related, but more bone related.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's get into that, because that's a marker that a lot of people are going to get. That's going to be on even a lot of their regular blood work that they're going to get. They're going to have alkaline phosphatase. But then even if we're going a little bit more specific, there's bone specific alkaline phosphatase too. So I'd love to learn, what's the connection between that lab marker, the alkaline phosphatase, and hyperthyroidism?
Yeah, so you're right. I mean, that is part of typically a comprehensive metabolic panel, which most people should get. I mean, they usually do get, but every now and then there'll be an endocrinologist who doesn't run that. But usually you want them to do the basics, like a complete blood count with differential, and a comprehensive metabolic panel definitely is up there as well. And so that marker alkaline phosphatase it's an enzyme, and it's an enzyme mainly found in the liver and the bone. It's found in a few other places like the kidney too, but mostly the liver and the bone. And so when you're doing a comprehensive metabolic panel, it's not really differentiating between the liver and bone. And that's why what you mentioned, there's actually like an alkaline phosphatase. It's called an isoenzyme test. And it, you know, can determine where specifically it's located in the body, if it's in the bone versus the liver. So again, rarely do doctors order that. And honestly, when I do a comprehensive metabolic panel, or when someone else does it, and I'm just reviewing the comprehensive metabolic panel, if someone has hyperthyroidism and the alkaline phosphatase is elevated, most of the time that's related to the bone turnover that we were talking about. The comprehensive metabolic panel also looks at the liver enzymes. So, I mean, if we see the ALT, the AST elevated, then maybe we could say, well, alkaline phosphatase, maybe some of that is due to the liver, but most of the time we're looking at the bone. And so if anybody is, you know, listening to this and, you know, they have that elevated alkaline phosphatase, and especially if they have hyperthyroidism, then that's common. And I don't get too concerned. You know, I've seen levels that the reference range will vary depending on the lab, but, you know, I've seen levels like over 200, sometimes close to 300. And it could take quite a while for it to decrease. So just to summarize, that elevated alkaline phosphatase relates to the bone turnover. And again, it doesn't necessarily mean that at that point you have osteopenia or osteoporosis, but if that marker stays elevated for quite a long time, that's usually because the thyroid hormone levels aren't under control, which, as I mentioned earlier, can lead to osteopenia, osteoporosis.
Can you talk about the inflammation that is associated with thyroid autoimmunity and how that's going to impact bone density also?
Yeah, so it's interesting because, you know, if someone has Graves' disease, that is also associated with hyperthyroidism. So we've been focusing on the impact of the thyroid hormone, which, you know, definitely can impact the bone. But what autoimmunity, not just Graves, but Hashimoto's, rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, all these autoimmune conditions, they're, you know, characterized by having what's called pro-inflammatory cytokines like TNF-alpha. And a big one when it comes to autoimmunity, interleukin-17. You know, many people also heard of interleukin-6, which is associated with a marker C-reactive protein or CRP. But interleukin-17 is a big one, and TNF-alpha. And there's research that shows that there's actually plenty of research that shows that these cytokines can increase bone loss. And the way they seem to do it is by increasing the osteoclast. So, you know, earlier I mentioned how the osteoblast with the B are important for bone formation, where the osteoclast with the C are involved in breakdown in bone. So if you have those increase, you know, of pro-inflammatory cytokines, that increases the osteoclast. And that also over time can lead to osteopenia and osteoporosis. And then on top of that, there's what's called regulatory T cells or Tregs. And, you know, with the regulatory T cells, they help to keep autoimmunity in check. So essentially calming down, you know, the immune system. And, you know, they inhibit the osteoclast. So you want to have plenty of regulatory T cells and, you know, you want to have, I mean, and cytokines are important, so they're not all inflammatory, but definitely want to do things to reduce inflammation, do things to increase regulatory T cells. And there's a number of things you could do for that, you know, like having healthy vitamin D levels. Selenium plays a big role, vitamin A, you know, even research shows probiotics can help with the increase in regulatory T cells.
That's great. And I'm glad you mentioned cytokines as well, because, I mean, even with primary osteoporosis, which is typically related to that decrease in estrogen in postmenopausal women, because estrogen has the protective effect on bone, as those levels decrease, as they do during menopause, that causes an increase in those cells that break down bone, the osteoclast. And specifically, you have interleukin-1 and interleukin-6 that are playing a big role in that, increasing the osteoclast activity. So I'm glad you kind of touched on that too. And then in terms of what are some of the ways in which people can address, you know, hyperthyroidism and Graves' disease? What are the different treatment options that are available, and why would someone pursue one over another?
Sure. So when you go to a medical doctor, typically, again, they'll refer a person with hyperthyroidism to an endocrinologist. And there's usually three treatment options, one of three that they'll recommend. So one would be antithyroid medication, which essentially is blocking the production of thyroid hormone. Methimazole is the most common type of antithyroid medication recommended. Tapazole, the main brand. There's also PTU, which is another one, and another type of antithyroid medication. Sometimes they will get beta blockers too. That's not uncommon, such as propranolol or atenolol. And that's more affecting the cardiovascular system. Although some of them, like propranolol, will affect the conversion of T4 to T3 as well. So it's not uncommon for medical doctors to put someone on methimazole and the propranolol. And so that's one way, is through the medication. And then a second way, again, this is the conventional route, would be radioactive iodine, where they're using radioactive iodine to ablate the thyroid gland, pretty much kill the cells of the thyroid gland. And, by doing this, it will usually take care of the hyperthyroidism. Not all the time. Some people do need a second or third dose of radioactive iodine. But essentially, that's the goal with that. And then, of course, there's thyroid surgery, which is the third option. And so with thyroid surgery, a complete thyroidectomy usually is recommended if they recommend thyroid surgery to, completely remove the thyroid gland. And, of course, there's risks and benefits of all three of these. With the antithyroid medication, the benefit is that, you could give the person the antithyroid medication right away. And usually it does a good job of lowering the thyroid hormone levels. The downside is that side effects are common. So we spoke about the liver. Sometimes it does raise the liver enzymes. Sometimes it could depress the white blood cell count. Sometimes it could lead to other symptoms such as dizziness or skin rashes. And, so again, that's why a lot of people read when they learn about hyperthyroidism, they'll learn about the medication. They'll be nervous about, taking the medication. And it's understandable. Although, of course, everything comes down to risk versus benefit. So there is a time and place for the medication. And honestly, if I had a choice between taking a medication or receiving radioactive iodine or thyroid surgery, I would definitely, go for the medication. And, I'll talk about what I did for my hyperthyroidism. But the problem with radioactive iodine thyroid surgery is that they don't do anything to address the cause of the problem. So while they will, especially with thyroid surgery, if you get the thyroid gland taken out, the hyperthyroidism will definitely be permanently gone. But now you're faced with having to take thyroid hormone replacement on a permanent basis. And besides that, if you have Graves' disease, that's an autoimmune condition. And if someone has one autoimmune condition, the research clearly shows that they're at increased risk of developing other autoimmune conditions in the future. So if they just receive either radioactive iodine or thyroid surgery and don't do anything to address the immune system, there's no guarantee they'll develop another autoimmune condition, but there is an increased likelihood. And even if someone has a non-autoimmune thyroid condition, such as toxic multinodular goiter, it's still not addressing the cause of the problem. There, you want to, whenever possible, at least attempt to address the cause of the problem. Again, there's a time and place I mentioned for medication. There's also a time and place for thyroid surgery, but in most cases, it should be a last resort. And then when it comes to the natural approaches, so when I dealt with Graves, again, remember, I did attend some of those functional endocrinology seminars, so I kind of knew there were alternatives. And one of those alternatives is an herb called bugleweed. And bugleweed is an herb with antithyroid properties. And so when I was dealing with hyperthyroidism and eventually diagnosed with Graves, I figured, why not just at least give it a try? I definitely wasn't opposed to taking a medication if I had to, but I figured, I wasn't at the time taking anything, so I'll give the herbs a try. And I started with bugleweed. Eventually, I added something called motherwort, which is another herb, and that helps with the cardiovascular system and help. I took that because I was still experiencing palpitations. But the combination of the bugleweed and motherwort really helped. My thyroid hormone levels definitely lowered while I was addressing a cause, which is important to mention. Whether you're taking the medication or you're taking herbs, they're not doing anything to address the cause. So I was doing things to improve my health overall, my diet, and doing things from a stress management perspective. I mean, with Graves, and we could dive into this if you want to further, but we want, with any autoimmune condition, you want to find and remove the triggers, do things to heal the gut. So whatever approach you take, you want to definitely do things to address the underlying cause. But that's, yeah, so that's the approach I took. And again, I work with a lot of people who are already taking the medication, and I never tell them to stop taking a medication. That's, of course, up to them. But, you know, the herbs sound great, but they don't work in everyone. They're not effective in everyone. So if someone is taking a medication, and if it seems like it's, and if it's, well, usually it does control the symptoms, but if it's not really causing any side effects, they're tolerating it well, you know, again, there's nothing wrong with staying on the medication. Now, that being said, there are still people who learn about me, and then, you know, they hear my story, or they hear other people I helped, and they want to, you know, stop taking the meds and, you know, take the herbs again. So I would never say just abruptly stop taking a medication. That's something between you and your prescribing doctor. But again, I understand the herbs are definitely something that a lot of people, including myself, find appealing. And so those are basically, you know, the I mentioned the conventional. And then, I mean, there are other natural approaches. There's L-carnitine, which I'm sure you're familiar with, but when taken in higher doses, the research shows that could have anti-thyroid properties as well. Lemon balm is another one commonly used in hyperthyroidism. There's iodine too, which is very controversial because iodine could actually, you know, exacerbate one's thyroid or autoimmune thyroid condition. But in some cases, they'll use higher amounts of iodine, which can actually sometimes do the opposite and suppress the thyroid hormone levels. But so typically that's not my first resort. If someone wants to take a natural approach, I'll, you know, start out like I did with the bugleweed and the motherwort.
And I like what you're talking about here too, is like you've mentioned multiple times as you're going through and you're talking about, you know, these two herbs and some of these other compounds and things that you can incorporate, but you're still going back to, you still have to figure out and address the root cause, right? You can take these things, you could do these things. And by the way, we're not just saying, go take these things. It's like, if it makes sense for your situation. And exactly. You know, obviously if somebody looks over your case and says, hey, okay, this may make sense, but you still have to reduce your stress, improve your sleep, do your exercise, get your nutrition in place, you know, put your autoimmune disease into remission, is the whole goal here. And then, could you spell out, because some people were probably trying to write that down, could you spell out how you spell those herbs? And then I'd also love to know, What did you find from your research that was the right dosing and, you know, the frequency and things like that to take those things?
Sure. So spelling wise, bugleweed, B-U-G-L-E-W-E-E-D, and then motherwort, like mother, one's mother, M-O-T-H-E-R-W-O-R-T. And those are the two main ones. And again, there's lemon balm as well. Which I didn't take when I dealt with, I just stuck with the, as far as the symptom management herbs, the bugleweed and motherwort. So dosing, it really depends. There's different potencies when it comes to herbs. So what I took, one to two extract, the thing is with bugleweed and motherwort, it's not like vitamin D or, you know, comparing it with another herb. It's not like ashwagandha where you could go to any health food store and pretty much get ashwagandha. With bugleweed, there's only a few different brands of bugleweed. So some of them are one to two, some of them are one to five, the one to five extract, less potent than the one to two. So I took a one to two extract and I took a teaspoon, which is 5 milliliters twice per day. And but it depends on the person. Some people will take less than that. They might take half a teaspoon twice a day. If they're taking a one to five extract, they might need to take a couple of teaspoons twice a day. Sometimes if the thyroid hormone levels are extreme, I might give it three times a day. Motherwort's more based on the symptoms. So, you know, whereas again, bugleweed, it's more on the thyroid hormone levels. So with motherwort, you know, you really just got to pick a dosing. So like if someone buys a bottle, and if again, like I took also like 5 milliliters twice per day. And, you know, that was just really the starting point for me. You know, I didn't know at the time, would that be enough to control the palpitations, or, you know, would that potentially be too much? I mean, it's hard to know if you take too much motherwort. I mean, things, I guess, could slow down a little bit too much, but with bugleweed, potentially if you take too much, it could lower thyroid hormone levels, make them hypo. I will say that's not as common as, like, if you do that with methimazole, like the antithyroid medication, it's very common for someone to take that and become hypo very quickly. Bugleweed, it could happen, but it's a more gradual process. I mean, it's, essentially, that's what you want. You want the numbers while you're addressing a cause of a problem. You want to see the thyroid hormone levels start getting to the hypo side, because that'll tell you that you don't need as much bugleweed, for example. Or even if you take the antithyroid medication, if you're addressing a cause of a problem, how do you know it's working? How do you know it's not the meds or the bugleweed that's, and because they are going to be affecting the thyroid hormone levels. And the way is, again, you want them eventually to be towards the hypo side as your health improves. And then that's an indication that it's time to reduce the dose. And, you know, if you're taking the medication, again, to go to the prescribing doctor and have them, you know, reduce the dose. But yeah, so those are as far as, like, you know, dosing instructions. They will vary, but, you know, what a lot of people do is if they purchase it on their own, they'll follow the instructions given on the bottle. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, if you do that, you know, from a motherwort perspective, again, you could just go by your symptoms. Did it help with the palpitations, for example, even the resting heart rate to some extent? With bugleweed, you could do that as well, because it will affect the symptoms by lowering the thyroid hormone levels. But really, the only way to know, like, are the how much better the thyroid hormone levels are is by doing a follow-up blood test.
Great. And this has been really helpful for people to really understand hyperthyroidism and Graves' disease and the impact that has on our bones, and then some actionable things that we could take away from this. And I do want to ask, are there any other things that you think are important to for our audience to understand about hyperthyroidism and Graves' disease, anything like that?
Well, I mean, you know, I know we focused a lot on Graves' disease. There are, I mentioned briefly, like, there's toxic multinodular goiter, which is also probably the second most common type of hyperthyroidism. And that's when, you know, like, a goiter is essentially a swelling of the thyroid gland, increased size of the thyroid gland, and then nodules, little, you know, think of it as little growths on the thyroid gland. And so that's what multinodular goiter is, multiple nodules in the presence of the goiter. And a lot of people have a multinodular goiter without hyperthyroidism, but then there's the toxic multinodular goiter. And then some people have subacute thyroiditis, which is more viral induced. So again, when it comes to these, a lot of what we mentioned apply. You still want to address the cause of the problem. You still want to be safe. You want to manage the symptoms safely. Subacute thyroiditis sometimes is a little bit tricky because it's more transient. And even with Hashimoto's, there's a Hashitoxicosis, where you could get Hashimoto's presenting with hyperthyroidism. And again, it's usually transient, but it gets a little bit tricky because you don't want to necessarily give the person antithyroid medication, because if they're fluctuating back and forth, or if it's just transient, and if someone's taking the antithyroid medication, they might become extremely hypo. So that gets a little bit tricky to manage. And just as you mentioned, Kevin, just addressing the cause of the problem. You know, what I recommend is, you know, we spoke a lot about managing the symptoms, but I'm also big into trying to find out what the triggers are. You know, there could be different triggers. It could be food triggers. Stress is a big trigger. You know, infections like H. pylori, when it comes to both Graves and Hashimoto's, you know, could be a potential trigger. You know, we've heard of viruses such as Epstein-Barr, and, you know, even stealth infections such as Lyme disease. You know, chemicals, environmental toxins and toxicants such as, you know, mycotoxins and heavy metals such as mercury. I mean, all these can play a role in the development of these conditions, especially, you know, thyroid autoimmunity conditions such as Graves' disease. So it's not always easy to find or remove the triggers. But what I will say is everyone listening could at least start by cleaning up their diet, blocking out time to manage stress, you know, trying to do things to get, making sure you're getting sufficient sleep, which sometimes is a catch-22 because the hyperthyroidism may cause insomnia, and you might, again, need to lower those thyroid hormone levels. And then exercise, I'll say this, because this is important too. It's, you know, everybody knows it's important to exercise. With hyperthyroidism, I mean, it's important to be active regardless, but you want to be cautious too, because if someone has a resting heart rate, and in some cases it could be like 120, 130, 140 resting, and, you know, you want to be cautious. One thing I didn't mention is, I think one of the factors that led to the development of my Graves' disease condition was overtraining. You know, the adrenals and stress were big, and emotional stressors were important, but I'm pretty sure I was overdoing it as well, prior to the diagnosis of Graves. So you just want to be careful if you have hyperthyroid. I mean, regardless if you have hyperthyroidism or not, you don't want to overtrain. But if you have hyperthyroidism, you know, I would say you probably don't want to do like high intensity interval training, you know, until you've restored your health. You might not even want to go, you know, running, you know, like, again, I hate saying this because I'm avid when it comes to exercising and working out. And currently I do high intensity interval training, but, you know, when you're trying to regain your health, you know, doing some walking, doing some definitely weight bearing exercises, which is important for muscle mass as well as bone density, you know, could help too. So I do encourage that, but yeah, so I would say definitely be cautious on the exercise side, but be active and again, do all those things on your own to, you know, at least start getting on the path to recovering.
And Dr. Eric, if people want to work with you and learn more about where you're at and what, and if they potentially want your help, you know, resolving some of their issues, where can they find you?
Yeah. So there's a few places. So my podcast, Save My Thyroid, which you could find either visiting savemythyroid.com or just go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, your favorite podcast platform, and, you know, type in Save My Thyroid. My original website actually is Natural Endocrine Solutions. And that's with that website, it has hundreds of articles and blog posts related to hyperthyroidism as well as hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's. So that's another resource. And then my books, which you mentioned earlier on, I have one natural treatment solutions for hyperthyroidism and Graves' disease. And for those listening of Hashimoto's, I do have one called Hashimoto's Triggers. So I'd say those are really probably the three main ways: my podcast, you know, the my articles and blog posts, as well as my books, my two books.
Awesome. Absolutely love it. And for those of you listening and watching right now, you can find all the resources, show notes, everything we mentioned over at bonecoach.com/Dr. Eric Osansky, hyperthyroidism, osteoporosis, bone loss. That's a long one. So again, I'll leave it in the show notes. So click it down there. Thanks so much for watching this. We'll see you in the next episode. Hey, it's Bone Coach Kevin Ellis. Hope you found that episode helpful and that you enjoyed it. Just one last reminder, if you haven't done so already, head over to bonecoach.com, sign up for your free 7-day osteoporosis kickstart. It's going to tell you everything you need to do to start getting on the path to improvement. Hope you found this helpful. I'm your Bone Coach Kevin Ellis. I'll see you soon.